What is up, everybody? Welcome back to Be the Number. I am your host, Spencer Aguiar, and I'm excited to be joined this week by Tom Jacobs. Tom is the host and creator of the Lost for Words podcast, and he also contributes weekly at Mayo Media Network, where he provides one of the best breakdowns in the industry of the European tour. You can find Tom on Twitter at TomJacobs93, and you can also get his written work if you check out the fantastic betting columns he releases over at oddschecker.com. Tom, it's a pleasure to have you on the program, man.
Spencer, that's a lovely introduction. That is one of your best assets. You always make the guests feel welcome. So yes, I'm certainly about in different places at the moment. I think I'm probably popping up on timelines maybe one too many times for certain individuals. But no, it's good. I think the important thing is obviously I cover both tours, so that's nice. And all the time you feel like you're adding value, right? You don't mind being in people's faces, and I certainly don't think I'm overstaying my welcome so far. So that's good.
I would agree with that. And, you know, one of the things I would say is I think there is an overall changing of the guard inside of the industry to an extent. And maybe it branches out a little further than a generic comment like that, since more jobs are opening up throughout with the legalization of sports betting inside the United States. But I do believe there are levels to this at the end of the day. It doesn't mean every week is perfect with the selections made for DFS or betting. But one of the things I do know about you is that you put out great content and research for your listeners and followers alike. That aspect in particular is obviously great, but I'm a firm believer that being able to provide well-informed viewpoints only comes when you're obsessed and dedicated with your craft. So first off, I just wanted to say the hard work doesn't go unnoticed. And in my opinion, you're definitely not popping up too much. But I'd love for you to talk to us a little bit about how you got started into this industry as a whole. Was there something that drove you to the golf side? And how long have you been doing this for in total?
So it's really strange, actually. So to be honest, it's a bit of a late bloomer, if you like, in golf. I never played it as a kid. I was always soccer orientated. I played it, coached it. Pretty much I worked in it, so you know that was my life for a long time. And then my dad is a golf fan. He when we used to have bets an awful lot, you know, once I turned 18, we used to do golf bets once a week, and I just found myself doing quite well. And Mike Miller, I don't know if you know, he was called Smart Golf Bets on Twitter. He used to provide a spreadsheet of current form and course form, and I always used to follow that. And very quickly I realized I could make some value from there, and actually started a golf betting article on the Football Family, which sounds a bit of a weird mix, in 2012. And then we actually branched the site to the Golf Family, and we did that for a couple of years. And then during the lockdown last year, obviously, I started the Lost for Words podcast, and I think that kind of took it to a new level for me. I think that once I was out there engaging that kind of content, I've always done a little bit of written content, but I think that podcasts are the future, right? I think that what we're doing here is kind of the way forward. And I don't think you can be a creator in the space without being able to present on camera as well. And, you know, both have really good assets to it. So when I do my Oddschecker articles that you mentioned there, like, it's so deep and so lost in writing everything that it does kind of focus your attention more, I'd say, than even if you do video content. So I think there's definitely a place for both. And ever since then, obviously, like you said, I joined the Mayo Media Network with Pat, and me and Sky do the European Tour show. And I think that was the biggest thing for me. Like, European Tour has kind of got a bit of a following your side of the pond now, whereas it didn't really before. And like you say, it's because, you know, legalizing the betting across the country is massive for us. I mean, we've always had it here. Once you can start getting each pay bets over there, it's going to be huge as well. So I think it's a really good time to be in the space, and it's only evolving from here.
I agree with you on that. We see this growing every single day. And as we both have mentioned, I mean, a lot of it has to do with the legalization of betting with it. And I've mentioned on this podcast before, but I don't come from a golf background myself. Pretty much everything I do is purely mathematical. I run my own personal model weekly to coincide with what that week's event is. And I mean, sure, there is a level of athletic prowess that I understand from competing in other sports at a high level. But as someone that has handicapped many different events in his time, the number one thing I would stress to anyone listening is to avoid any preconceived notions going into a week. I think that's a dangerous game to play. We see it in American football all the time when a team looks bad in prime time and quickly shifts across the public perception threshold because of one poor performance. And for the record, Tom, let it be known that I avoided all confusion by calling it American football there. I'm not sure I could name more than five soccer teams if I tried. So that's probably a topic for another day and show. But I think that point mixed with just shopping around for prices and betting or game selecting in DFS goes a long way for anyone that is struggling to build a bankroll. With that topic in mind, what is a couple things that you like from a handicapping perspective that you put into your work? That's something I ask all the guests that come on here. And I think it's an interesting perspective to get from different people of what they do from a handicapping perspective. And you can feel free to answer that for either betting or DFS.
Yeah. So, I mean, the majority of the stuff I do is betting. I mean, so when DFS first came over to here for DraftKings in the UK, I found it hard because I was putting up maybe four or five bets a week. And then if I could shoehorn them into a lineup, I was like, great, that's fantastic. I'll pick one more player and quickly go forward. And I realized that actually there's a lot more to it and a lot more sharper things that you have to apply a certain aspect to DraftKings as you do, or FanDuel as you do betting, right? So betting, you may be looking for people that are a bit more volatile, you know, long shot odds, that the guys that can win or miss the cut, whereas in fantasy you need six or six throughs the weekend, right? And that was something I always struggled with, was getting to players like Cameron Tringali that would be 9.5K on DraftKings. You think, well, you know, Cameron Tringali's got no shot of winning this event, and all of a sudden you're like, well, actually you quickly learn that top 11, top 10, top 8 consistently is really, really good. So that was the first thing that I kind of learned. But for me, something that I lean on, which I think is something that I don't think it makes me stand out, because I think a lot of people do it, but I think there's something that I really dive into is the correlative form. So I love making the links between, you know, the leaderboards. So for example, for Houston Open this week, there is 1 year of course form, right? So it's not like you've got a bank of form of players, you know, that have played there for 10 years. So where are the guys that finished well last year, played well previously? And once you start to realize that it applies, the same courses apply to the weaker guys up in the field, as well as the, you know, the likes of Dustin Johnson, Hideki Matsuyama, you start to get quite excited. And that's where I really start to dive in, really.
I like that answer, and I think we'll have a very intriguing show based off of that, because I am not a big comp course guy. A lot of what I do is from a, you know, a statistical perspective, some course history stuff with it, current form, all of that goes into the mix. So I think we'll get some unique perspectives with that when we do it, and, you know, go from there with it. And one of the things I will say is, just for anybody listening, the goal is to make the research as unique as possible to avoid too many similarities with other DFS players in the industry. And there are thankfully many ways to go about that with stat tools, podcasts, articles, and other resources that are released by plethora of quality content creators out there. Find what works for you and mold it into your own. But I think that's a good transition into the Houston Open this week. We have Memorial Park, 7,432 yards, par 70, Bermuda greens. It will be the second time we have seen this tournament take place at the venue in recent memory. It was hosted here last season, but hadn't been inside of the PGA Tour rotation since 1963 before that. It's actually one of the few municipal golf courses that is used on tour. It costs around $30 for adults and $10 if you are under 18, which typically lends itself to a thought process that the venue is easy. But we didn't get that last year with a winning score of 13 under from Carlos Ortiz. I've read that the property will be overseeded this time around, making it longer and slower. And the really difficult ravine areas that don't have water running through them should be slightly less penal than they were in 2020. I'll get into what I noticed from a one-year sample size shortly, but I'd like to hear what you see from the venue when you look at it and what stats you're honing in on for your research process.
Yeah, so I think that one of the really interesting things you say there is, I think that, you know, first of all, in general terms, I think there's a lot of people that will tell you to avoid the noise, right? Like, don't buy into so many different voices and you'll get lost and you'll struggle to make picks. But I don't think that's really true. I think as long as you take every single one person, like, you're going to come at it from a very different angle than I am. That doesn't mean that we necessarily disagree. It just means that you trust models and stat models and numbers, which I don't apply because I don't have my own models, but I do in a sense from current form and strokes gain approach, etc. But, you know, you design that for, you know, if you put in your model when it comes out, you take that number as thing, whereas I would go for more of a visual aspect of what I saw from last year. So like you said, it was really tough last year and people didn't expect that. And I listened back to a couple of previews that people did last year, and everyone was kind of going, oh, there's going to be a two in front of the winning score. It could be 25 under, it could be 23 under. And I was like, you know, why did we think that? Like, what was it about the golf course that made us think that? Is it because, I think there was a quote that came out from the superintendent that basically said that, you know, we're not here to beat par or sorry, whatever it was. And everyone was like, right, that means it's going to be birdies away. And the rough wasn't particularly penal. But we see it kind of, the runoff areas are similar to Augusta. So there's no bunkers because Brooks Koepka doesn't think bunkers are necessary for anybody. It's not hard for the PGA Tour pros and it's not inviting for the amateurs. So we've got that. And we've got a lot of long approaches in. That kind of took me, I mean, generally speaking, I think any Texas form generally tends to correlate across events. So I think anyone that plays well in Texas should get, I don't think you should suddenly play someone that's playing terribly just because they're playing in Texas, but give them a nudge if they're playing well as well. But there was three events that kind of stuck out to me. So it was the Genesis Invitational at Riviera. It was the Phoenix Open at TPC Scottsdale and the 3M Open, which was a really weird one, but I'll get on to why that was. But there was, those were the three events that kind of stuck out to me, and we'll get on to why in a moment.
You know, one of the things, just to backtrack for 1 second, that just to go back to that point of I'm building a model, you're not building a model. And this is one of the things, because like I do approach this from a statistical perspective, but it's really important to note that like we could be saying the same exact thing. We could be saying it differently in the way that we say it, or we could come up with two completely different answers. And, you know, the goal is to be right more than the other one, you know, over the long term duration of time. That's how you win money in gambling, is your opinion is above what the sports books are putting out. It's above what DFS users are doing with it. But it's an interesting note that like not every week is it going to be correct. And I think people that are listening, like you can figure out who you like, who you respect, who you think are putting out good opinions, and kind of just mold your decisions from there. And I think that's one of the things not enough people do, is that people kind of, like you're saying with it, think that if you get too many voices in your head that it's wrong. But I like the concept of listening to a bunch of people. I will never tell anybody to, you know, only listen to this show or only use my model. Like, obviously, Fantasy National has a great model that you can use. I would advise, you know, looking at mine also with it, just because you're going to get different answers based off of that. But as far as the course is concerned, you know, I think it's an intriguing one for a few reasons. You get five par threes and this heavy yardage total of over 7,400 yards for a par 70 layout. But I wouldn't call this venue where distance is the main proponent. Sure, I think that particular variable will help decide the winner, but accuracy is going to be just as important with the way the property is designed. You have these large specimen oak trees that are positioned to cause issues if you're wayward off the tee. And there are weird quirks throughout, including a clamshell landing area on the par 4 10th that will create problems if you go inside of it. A ravine runs through a handful of holes. And while not all misses will have water on them, there are a ton that will present a one-shot penalty. It is Texas, so you can anticipate some wind. The track does a good job of featuring dog legs that move in both directions. That fact mixed with the potential for gusts means we do need creativity and thought before hitting every shot. And we kind of see that with wide areas that feature small targets. The one difference I notice here that you don't always get at Tom Doak Designs is that there isn't a ton of undulation. With that being said, there are extreme misses where runoff areas are built to take your ball and make it challenging to get up and down. The greens are structured in a way where shots run away from you and can be tough to read. I will note, and you know, I'm very interested to get your perspective on why you like some of those courses in a second, but I have a 70-30 split of stats over current form. There is no course history. There is no comp courses in my thing, but I weighed seven stats in total. I started with total driving for 20%. That's about as high as I will get on a singular stat, but it was a very slightly geared towards distance over accuracy in a 57.5 versus 42.5% split. As I mentioned, the course has dog legs that go in both directions. And while distance will help, it isn't the only quantifiable variable because of the oak trees that are positioned throughout. I have 10% on courses over 7,400 yards. That should artificially add in some measurable totals like distance, long iron proximity, and just an overall ability to handle longer properties. 17.5% on par five birdie or better. 61.5% of Ortiz's winning total came from those three holes last year. Nearly 73% of Hideki's second place score, 66.6% of Gooch's fourth place output. The only outlier was DJ, who wins the tournament if he does better than 18%. I anticipate the venue playing marginally easier, so the impact might not be as grand, but the gettable holes still remain. I have 15% on weighted par four. That looked primarily at longer par fours. There are birdie holes at 5, 13, and 17, but I prefer trying to find how the players perform at par four stretching over 500 yards. Five of the seven most challenging holes come between 490 to 529, and I added in some bogey avoidance and long iron proximity to complete that category. Weighted par three for 7.5%. I felt compelled to weigh that category because there are five, but I didn't want to get overly caught up. These range all over the map in distance, and I tried to accurately assess that narrative by having, you know, each one solo that, you know, stood alone in that mix with it. 15% around the green plus GIR percentage. It's a one-year data total, so I would take it with a grain of salt, but 28.3% of the scoring dispersion came around the greens last year. That is 14.3% higher than tour average. I'd be cautious in placing too much emphasis there. Plus, it's been reported that the chipping areas will be less penal, but I do lean heavier on the around the green over GIR when combining those two. And then I wrapped it up with 15% on weighted proximity. That incorporates the full statistical breakdown of what we got last year. For reference sake, 82.5% of irons come from 125 yards and beyond. Some of the weighted par total categories include a deeper dive into specific ranges too. So I think marginally de-emphasizing approach play makes sense when it is added in as a secondary metric elsewhere. So when I ran that model from an overall rank sense, I got a top five of Sam Burns, Tony Finau, Sung Jae-im, Cameron Smith, and Joaquin Niemann. Top five for upside yielded Finau, Burns, Koepka, Scheffler, and Sungjae. Taylor Gooch placed eighth overall, and the biggest notable outlier, $7,000 or above for me, was Charlie Hoffman at 14th for upside, who comes into the week at 7,300. So I want to get some of your thoughts before we get into this range on why you included those courses that you did, Tom, with it. But run us through some of those courses a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think that anytime the model chucks out the names that they just chucked out to you, you're probably on the right lines because, you know, they are the betting favorites for a reason. They're up at the top of the scoring for a reason. So if you made a model and suddenly the bottom half of the DraftKings lineups were coming in, you'd be slightly worried. I liked what you said about the par four scoring because although, and I noticed, well, it's just a thing that the scoring will come from the par fives. That's just natural. It just happens on PGA Tour courses. I think to save your score more than anything, when that bogey avoidance we talk about is how you'll perform on those longer par fours. And I noted those 500-yard ones. I think there was three of them over 500 yards, and I think there was another six in total over 450. So I think it's really important to really hone in on those. And it kind of took me to, I mean, generally speaking, I think that you would get to the same courses for a different reason, right? So you would weight 7,400-yard courses, longer approach courses, etc. The way I get to it is just by looking at finishing positions. So for the Genesis, for example, Dustin Johnson's a two-time winner at Riviera, twice a runner-up, and he finished second here. Hideki Matsuyama loves Riviera. He's made five of seven cuts there, full fifth, ninth, 11th, and 23rd. And then he was second here as well. Before Carlos Ortiz won here, he was 26th, 20th, and 9th at Riviera, which was really impressive considering he hadn't quite emerged yet. Taylor Gooch had 10th and 12th place finishes at Riviera before finishing 4th here and 4th at the Houston Open the year before in a different venue as well. Sam Burns held the 36 and 54-hole lead at Riviera this year and was the 54-hole leader last year in this event. You know, so he's played well in both courses. And Francesco Molinari was tied 8th at Riviera earlier this year when he was struggling at that course in general and also finished tied 15th here when out of form. So that was what really struck me to the Genesis Invitational. And then when you think about what the Genesis Invitational requires, it's long approaches, tough greens, decent mow-off areas. You know, it fits in with the bills. And then the Phoenix Open was very similar. Carlos Ortiz has finished 4th and 25th there and won here 12 months ago. Matsuyama loves Phoenix. Anyone that follows Matsuyama, he's got two of his seven wins come from there. He's also got a second and a fourth and two more top 16s there. Brooks Koepka's a two-time Phoenix winner and was tied 5th here, went out of form. Adam Long was 5th going into the final round in Phoenix in 2020 and dropped to 8th. So that was kind of what the Phoenix Open threw out for me. And then the really one that was probably the hardest for me to kind of defend, and I don't think anyone else will probably come up with this, and if they do, then great, was the 3M Open. Carlos Ortiz finished 5th at the 3M before winning here. Sam Burns finished 7th before finishing, you know, being the 54-hole leader here. Sepp Straka and Taylor Gooch had got tied 18th finishes at the 3M, which Doesn't sound great in isolation, but this was before they kind of broke through the consistent players that they are now. Adam Long was second at the 3M Open before finishing 11th here. Michael Thompson won the 3M Open before, and he really struggled after winning that, and then finished 15th here when out of form. Maverick McNealy was 16th in the 3M this year, but he was actually second after 54 holes, and he was tied 20th last year here after shooting a pair of 67s over the weekend. And then you've got Matsuyama and Hovland that have played both of those well as well. So for me, I kind of weighted all three of those. And the trouble with doing that, Spencer, is exactly the opposite of what you do, is that you'll run the numbers, and if they work, then that'll ignore people. Say there was a guy that missed all of the cuts, every single, you know, finishes at those courses. If he fits the model, then he should go forward. And I can kind of fall in the trap of going, right, well, he didn't play very well at the Phoenix, you know, and the 3M, so I'll chuck him out. And it doesn't work like that. And I have to make sure I don't get caught up in that. And I've made sure I've got a balance of picks for each.
Well, there's definitely a lot of pros and cons to both ways of doing it. I mean, there's ways with my model that are suboptimal in a way also with it. So, I mean, a lot of it is deeper diving situations to make things work. And based off of those three comp courses that you used, I have a general feeling that we're going to like a lot of the same players this week, because even indirectly not trying to find comp courses, like when you build things certain ways for particular venues, players are going to pop out well if, you know, they're well suited for those courses. So I think it's going to be interesting, but let's start with the top of the board this week. So we have seven players priced above $10,000. Sam Burns leads the way at $11,100 and is followed by Scottie Scheffler, $10,900, Sung Jae Im, $10,700, Tony Finau, $10,600, Matthew Wolff, $10,400, Cameron Smith, $10,200, and Tyrrell Hatton, $10,000. When you see this board, talk to us with what stuck out to you.
I mean, look, Sam Burns is there for a reason. He's a favorite in the betting board. He's a favorite in the field here because, you know, not only was he the 54-hole leader here last year, but he's also been probably one of the best golfers, especially in this field, over the last year or so. So he deserves to be there. I cannot put anybody off if they wanted to pick him, and I will start some lineups with him. Scottie Scheffler, I was a little bit disappointed yesterday. You know, he had that horrendous Ryder Cup debut. And he's been in contention an awful lot. And he felt like Tony Finau, where everyone was kind of saying he can't win. Then it was going to come because he was too good. And then it's just a matter of variance. And then it's just a matter of regressing to the mean, et cetera, et cetera. And then you just watch him miss a couple of really, really poor putts yesterday. And that may be because of the past Padam greens and Bermuda, maybe a bit of truer surface for him. But if I was going to potentially fade one, it would possibly be him, because at 10,900, you need him to kind of win. I don't really want to be starting my teams without someone that I think can win. And I really, really like Matthew Wolff in this range. I think that the way he's been playing so far this season has just been unbelievable. You know, he's back to kind of what he does best, you know, hitting the ball long, generally pretty straight for someone that hits it as far as he does. He's very streaky as a putter. I wouldn't say he's the best putter in the field by any means, but he's very good at, you know, getting on the run with that. And he's finished 17th, 2nd and 5th, his first three starts of the season. And if there's anything in that 3M link, then obviously he won his first PGA Tour event there and finished 12th as well. So Matthew Wolff for me was my favourite at the top.
It's interesting you went with Wolff. That might be the one spot that we're a little bit different on this week. You know, I kind of keep sounding like a broken record on this show every single week, but the pricing once again looks to be pretty stout to me. Five of the top six players are inside the top six of my overall rank. We've seen 11 of the last 12 winners placed inside the top 15 on my model, with seven of the nine coming in at fourth or better of either the overall or upside rank portions. And the one thing I will say to that is I'm not incorporating Vegas metrics or any DraftKings prices into that build. I am building something that is just my own model with it. Like, I have a feature built into it where I can incorporate some of the Vegas pricing into it, but I'm trying to beat Vegas pricing. I'm trying to beat DraftKings pricing with it. I'm trying to figure out where my edges are. So the less I add to that, the better. But to me, that signifies, even if we haven't picked the eventual winner or on an outright ticket every week, the standalone DFS picks continue to be placing us in the proper range of talent. Now, that's where it gets a little tricky trying to narrow down the group, but I will provide a few thoughts on all the options. Ownership is still trickling into the market at the time we are recording the show, so some of these decisions might become easier if we get an outlier number of any sort. But I agree with you. I don't have any problem with Sam Burns' price. He's number one for me in safety, number one overall, second for upside. We have seen Bermuda be his best putting surface per round by nearly 0.36 shots over Poa and Bent. If we remove his start at the Tour Championship, he has gained 6.84 strokes tee to green over his last seven tournaments. I don't love the early ownership numbers because I believe you can start with a handful of guys beneath him. That's even including going into the 9K range. I think there are some guys up there to get contrarian with it, but I don't see anything wrong with him, and I wouldn't take him out of my player pool for consideration. I think he's one of the choices to look at. I kind of like Scottie Scheffler a little bit. I think you can make the argument that he's overpriced where he's currently at right now, but it starts becoming intriguing for me if this can pivots into contrarian nature with it, and it might not. Ownership might go enough to where that doesn't end up being the case, but at 10,900, I assume there's going to be a lot of people that don't want to pay that price for him. And if I'm getting him at a contrarian pivot there, I think he's an intriguing play. He usually does a good job of keeping momentum rolling once he gets hot. And I don't anticipate that changing here after he did finish fourth place last week. We can say it was a little bit disappointing, but you know, right now I'm looking at him at 15%. So that's a little bit high. I would anticipate that dropping a little bit. We'll see what ends up happening with that. But, anything in that like 10 to 12% range, I really like. He's seventh overall in this field when it comes to total driving and then finished inside the top 10 in my par five birdie or better category. Sungjae is technically correctly priced on my spreadsheet, but the one concern I have with him is he's lost with his irons in three of his past four starts. He's had to average 4.56 around the green over his last three to make up for that. And these aren't surfaces you want to miss. Finau was the number one ranked player from a statistical perspective. He graded inside the top 50 in all metrics, including ranking top 10 in weighted proximity around the green plus GIR, weighted par three, weighted par four, and courses over 7,400 yards. And if we're just using the comp course narrative, Finau does fit a lot of those courses with the way he's performed there. As I said, Wolf, I mean, technically he's 14th in my model, and maybe this is sometimes where I get caught up in trusting my numbers a little bit too much, because I mean, it's not as if 14th doesn't give him a chance to win the tournament, but I'm going to probably be out on him unless the ownership gets down a little bit more. I think Cameron Smith is an intriguing golfer. If he's around 10%, we'll see what ends up happening there. He's 23 ranking spots better in proximity at this course versus an average PGA Tour stop. And comes into this week ranked second in par five birdie or better, sixth in weighted par three, and sixth in strokes gained total over my long-term model. And then Hatton has the most negative components attached to him of the entire group. He does carry a positive GPP increase that could make him worth a look if the ownership places him in the low man on the totem pole range. But he looks to be holding steady with the rest of the range in popularity. So as of right now, if you made me tear off this group, I like Finau, Cam Smith, Scheffler, and Burns. I'm going to give deeper dives to them, see where their popularity comes in, and then I don't like Sungjae probably because of his irons. I don't like Hatton with where he's at. And I will do a deeper dive into Matthew Wolf, see if I can find something there. But those are the three for me right now that would be out. As I said, ownership could change a few of those things around there. But let's move into the $9,000 range where we have another really strong group by my math. There are seven players to choose from. And I don't hate the idea of going flatter on builds and starting in this range with two or three being entered into that lineup, especially if you go the contrarian route that I will get into shortly. That will quickly get you away from the popular roster constructions and large field events. But options are open for how you want to handle it. I think the four I mentioned, add Matthew Wolf into the mix as the preferred choices up top, are certainly very much in play as the first man into your build because of a mixture of where they are ranked in my model plus overall ownership versus the 9K section as a whole. But I don't mind a mix and match approach either. The routes you can take are truly wide open. Do you see things any differently here? And how do you view the 9K zone in general?
Just to backtrack a little bit in terms of Cameron Smith is that the record he's had recently, he could very easily have won three events in 2021. And if that's he true. Did, we'd be talking about a completely different golfer, right? And I don't think necessarily, I guess the one that he kind of lost to Finau in the playoffs maybe was a bit of his fault, and he had a bad day at the WGC for St. Jude on the final day. But generally speaking, this is a guy that's really, really improved, and he's played really well at Augusta, which is another comp course as well. So I would agree that if Smith is lower ownership to the others, then I would certainly pick him. I just expected him to be slightly popular due to the lower price. In the 9K range, for me, Taylor Gooch and Aaron Wise are the most obvious guys to pick. I think they're both hot right now. Taylor Gooch is going to fit all the statistical models, I imagine. He hits his irons very, very well. I've generally gone for Carlos Ortiz in this range just because I like the fact that And this is where it kind of comes into feel as opposed to numbers, I'd have thought, because by numbers, he's probably not the best in his range. But he generally repeats his form really, really well. So we've already spoken about the fact that he plays Genesis really well. He's always, he backs up his Mayakoba's efforts for 2 seconds and an eighth there. You know, he can go back to a course and really do well. And he finished fourth in the Houston Open in 2019, then won it this year. Obviously, different courses, but same area. And I just fully trust him to go back and do the same thing. Now, there was a slight concern in the broadcast yesterday that he's got a bit of a shoulder injury, which is what led to him withdrawing at the Zozo. So I would keep an eye on that. But the other guy is Adam Scott. And after a little while of just struggling with his game, I think he struggled with the lockdown in general, maybe being stuck in Australia, not being able to get back as often as he would like. But since that's kind of passed, he had that second at the Wyndham where he had the chance to win in that bigger playoff there. He was 14th over in Wentworth when he came over to the European Tour. 35th at the Shiners. Wasn't great, but it was a decent enough effort. And then he was 5th at the CJ Cup. And for me, 68, 63, 67, 69 was just some really solid golf. He came up 4 shots shy. But when I see someone come up 4 shots shy and finishing 8th, like, I know it's very easy to say, and you could say this about any number and any person, but that's just one extra birdie around, or one less drop shot around, or whatever, just turning one par into a birdie. And when it's just 4 shots throughout the whole course of a week, that suggests to me that he was very close to winning that tournament. He's 3 for 3 in cuts made, 101.8 fancy points per game, and 9,600, I don't think he's a bad place to start.
Yeah, I think this $9,000 range in general is a really good one. You know, I guess the one I would add to that mix, or I guess two of them that I would add to the mix that you didn't say, because I like everybody that you mentioned also. I've been a pretty big proponent of no Brooks Koepka and non-majors over the past few months, but I'm willing to come off of that stance this week at the tag of $9,900. This would be GPP only if you're going to play him, but he is the biggest model increase I have when it comes to win equity versus overall rank. Now, I will say, I think if you're using the stance of Koepka helping Doak design Memorial Park as your sole stance, that's probably lazy handicapping. But there is something to it when he is showing as one of the better upside plays without that being correlated into my model. I love the early ownership projections. I'm not sure he will stay sub 10%, but he creates some of the best leverage of pure upside or out of the box, outside of the box, thinking of anybody up here. I think Adam Scott makes a lot of sense for the reasons you mentioned. I'm probably not going to add anything to Gooch and Wise that you're not going to be able to hear throughout the industry. I mean, they're going to be two very popular choices. I don't think that means that you can't play them. They're inside the top six for me in safety. I think there's a lot that they do well. The other name that I really like is Joaquin Niemann at 9,500. I think a lot of that is in the same mold of Koepka with the thought process there. I don't think there's a huge difference between him and Gooch and Wise, I guess, to put all three of them into the mix there. But we see the latter two at 2 times, or actually over 2 times the ownership percentage of where Niemann is at less than 10% right now. I know people continue to be frustrated by him because of his putter, but he's gained with his irons in 19 of his last 23 trackable starts, and off the tee in 33 of 37. Perhaps that's something that he can use to an advantage at a venue where missing the greens can be very deadly. Just to add Carlos Ortiz a quick thought on him, he actually graded 12th overall for me, which puts him right as a fine value where he is. He's actually a spot on value, and Ortiz isn't somebody who usually grades out as a positive value. So I think for all the reasons you mentioned with it, and then my model also sees an advantage against ownership against him. Like right now, I see him a little over 12%. I think that's completely fine. I think there's a lot of encouraging things. And as you said, he can repeat his success with it. That pretty much covers it from that range for me, though. I don't know if we missed anybody else that you'd like to discuss further. I guess the one we missed would be Patrick Reed. Do you have any thoughts on him?
No, I mean, just going to Brooks Koepka, I mean, from a betting versus DFS kind of standpoint, I mean, he's the volatile guy, right? So when he gets to 30-1 in betting markets, you tend to have a go on Brooks Koepka and hope that the upside wins out. He can very easily win this golf event. I wouldn't feel particularly comfortable playing him in DFS, but just because I think there's something generally lingering with him in terms of injury or bad form or whatever it is. But like you say, when it comes to low ownership and sub 10% for someone of his winning upside, then it's worth putting him in there. Patrick Reed, played very well at Bermuda. He finished second in a tough event. From a betting standpoint, he was obviously 22-1 in a very poor field. But he's just not been the same golfer, right? You know, this is a guy that we tend to rely on tough events. This would be something that would be up his alley. He's played well in Texas before. He's played well at Augusta. I just don't trust him. And at 9,000, I think there's plenty of other better options around.
I would agree with you on the stance with Reed. He's probably my least favorite of all seven options with it. And then just to touch on the Koepka comment, I would agree. I think he is a better outright bet than anything else. I think where he makes the most sense if you're going to use him in DFS contests would be the really large field events. I think if you're playing single entry and three max, I don't think that's a must that you have to get to him. I think you can build lineups the other way. I think he's too volatile. I think there's a lot of downside to him, but he does have potential to win this tournament. And if we're talking about big field tournaments, that's kind of what I'm looking for in Koepka. So that's where I'm going to be playing him if I'm using him. He's one of the guys I do have an outright ticket on right now at 30-1. He was the first bet I made. But I will keep this pretty simple in the 8,000s. On my model, it's almost straight red when trying to find value in GPPs. It's not as if we're talking about players outside of my top 50. But the ownership group is hovering in that 15th to 40th zone while still carrying notable ownership. If we remove that important ownership part altogether, some of these looks do get a little bit better. Henley does have good proximity numbers to be competitive. He ranks fourth in this field for this specific iron layout. The issue is he's probably one of the worst par five scorers on tour for what I would consider a good player. We got a 29th out of him last year at the track. Something like that seems in play again. That probably makes him a better cash play. A similar thought for Mark Leishman, two top fours in his last three, six made cuts in a row, 14 consecutive rounds of par or better, placing him fifth in this tournament for that stat behind Wise, Varner, Power, and M. I'm more inclined to take a shot on his upside than someone like Henley in GPPs, and he still carries good cash playability. I think Leishman's fine, and I almost would say the same thing about the entire group in general of Bezuidenhout, McNealy, Seamus, Tringali, all are top 21 in cash for me. Maybe there's a route to go extremely safe on a build and stack a handful of those together. But once again, it keeps taking me back to the same thought process of cash preferred when breaking down these golfers. I'd rather take minor shots here and there on GPPs if I'm going to play them. And I guess the one that I'm the most intrigued with bucking the trend of my model would be Max Homa at sub 5%. If we're talking comp courses, he has some success there. Obviously, he won the Genesis, so I mean, that's as good as you're going to get there. He's very hit and miss, but has winning upside to go along with gaining with his irons in 7 and 9 and off the tee in 12 of 17. I typically prefer him on courses that are more challenging, like the one that he's going to draw in Texas. And he has proven to be a very solid win player throughout his career. But that'll do it for me in the 8,000s. Anything I missed that you like or anyone you are higher on than I am?
So Max Homa is my favorite play completely here. I think the value is great. I think that because he's so inconsistent and he is that volatile figure that is better to bet on DFS, right? I think that puts him at a lower salary than he's probably worth. You know, this is a guy who's won three times since 2019. He won at Riviera, as you mentioned. He finished fifth the year before that, and he was third at the 3M Open and sixth at the Phoenix Open. So I couldn't really ignore those things for me. So for me, I had a 50 or 55 to one outright ticket on him. Now, when you look at when he was 48th last year, he was coming off the back of some poor form. He just traveled over from Bermuda, and he was also playing his first Masters the week after. So I think there was a lot going on in that short window that really probably would put Homa off. And I think that the fact that he's come back here this week speaks volumes about the fact that he thinks this is probably a good chance for him. I imagine that Quail Hollow comes into some models for the longer approaches, and that probably helps him as well. That's his other tour victory. I'd be interested to see how Maverick McNealy and Seamus Power get on. Obviously, you mentioned McNealy in the course correlations. Seamus Power is just playing very, very well in general. And Jason Kokrat's going to be off people's radars an awful lot at the moment. You know, I don't quite know the numbers in terms of statistically how he's standing out, but obviously missed cut 54th in his first two events this season. But generally speaking, in Texas, he's been absolutely brilliant. And again, that's from a narrative point of view, it could be a chance to get back and get right for Kokrak. And this is a guy that was always good at these type of golf courses. You know, he's got a runner-up finish at the Genesis back in the day, or the Northern Trust, as it was called then. You know, two-time winner since then, once won at the Charles Schwab, which is a Colonial in Texas. He's played well there again before as well. Byron Nelson, he's played well. So I just think that there's lots to like about Jason Kokrak from a Texas standpoint, if that's something you're going to buy into.
Yeah, so the two guys in this range that possess the biggest upside in win equity from what their price is versus the movement. So when I take my, what I guess the better way to explain that is when I take my overall rank and I look at them, and then I take the upside rank, the two biggest improvements there would be Homa and Kokrak. And I guess the thing with Kokrak is the form has been horrible. If you can get around that, and like, once again, this is GPP only. I would not play him in cash. I wouldn't touch him anywhere near that. But he makes a substantial move in GPPs. Right now, he's looking like he's going to be less than 10% owned, which most of this range is trickling above 10%. So I like the Kokrak call. I certainly think that there's something that could pop for him there. He's a good win player. He's a good total driver. There's things that at least work for him. And I like the Homa outright ticket that you punched with it. I think Homa's upside is so much better than you would think when you look at him. It's just, he's volatile. Like you said, when you have volatility, you're going to always be put in price ranges that you probably shouldn't be in, and you're a better player. And he might miss the cut. Maybe he's a better outright bet for that reason. Maybe you can find a way to play him in different variations of that. But I like all your calls from there. And but let's move into the $7,000 section. And I usually go through this as one massive group, but I guess let's split this up and condense it in so we can have a little bit of a deeper talk. So let's say 7,900 to 7,400. Who are a handful of your favorite plays there?
Yes, I like Mackenzie Hughes right up there at 7,900. Harold Varner at 77. I think Mito Pereira could be a good bounce back option. And I'd be interested to see what Chad Ramey does here as well. He's been playing some really good golf, but I don't really know quite how the course would fit. I know a guy in Jason Day has obviously got a lot of upside if he can get back. I know you're a fan, so he's in that range as well. But yeah, those would be the guys I'd be targeted. Mackenzie Hughes loves a tough event, generally plays well when you expect him not to. Maybe if the scoring gets a little bit lower here, that may not play into his hands. I think maybe if it was as tough as it was last year, that would help. And the only thing slightly worrying about him is that he did all his scoring kind of on the final day last year. I think he shot 7 under on the last day and finished 7 under for the tournament. So that would be a slight concern for me. But Mito Pereira, I think he could, you know, play well. He played very well at the 3M Open earlier in the year. There is a slight concern that Bermuda is not his putting surface, as someone mentioned to me earlier on Twitter, but I don't want to start chucking people out based on green surfaces already. And someone like Mito Pereira's PGA Tour career, he might not be the youngest, but this is a new arena for him. And if I started ruling him out because it was Bermuda, I'd be struggling to play anyone in any fields this week.
I think that's a really good point about not chucking people out of lineups or bets from just a purely bet or putting perspective. And I am like the least proponent of putting that there is in this industry. Like, I don't weigh a ton of putting into my metrics ever, but even when you look at any of these guys, the splits between them from one surface to another, most of them are, you know, a fifth of a stroke difference per round. And that's something that somebody can get hot for a given weekend and change those numbers around. So I think throwing that out is a dangerous game to play. You touched on a couple players that I like. I'll try to mention some other ones or at least add a couple additional points, I guess, to the ones that you said. I like Erik van Rooyen at 7,800. I think he carries some of the better value we've talked about so far. He's 11th in my model from both an overall and upside sense. He finished 20th at the course last year. That can probably be explained by him ranking 7th in weighted proximity and 11th in total driving when trying to mimic the track in my weights. We talked about Mito a little bit. I guess the one thing I will add to Mito is I think this is a really good price for him. I think for that reason, the ownership hasn't gone crazy. Like, now we're in like a real zone where he's not over $9,000. He's not 25%. Like, we're looking at a Mito Pereira that's in the 7,000s who's, you know, going to be between 10 and 15%. So I think that the upside's there. I guess the only problem I have from him, it's been four straight events for him of finishing 30th or worse. I'm interested to see where that ownership ends up landing, but I just think he's too good of a value where he currently is right now. I really like Chad Ramey at 7,500. I think he seems to be one of the better Korn Ferry prospects that's yet to get full recognition for his skills. His off the tee game has left something to be desired at times. But I have him 13th with his driver for this specific layout versus ranking 87th at a neutral track. His ability to hit it long and straight should be a major benefit. Kevin Streelman, 7,500, burned me last week, but he was inside the top 30 at sub 5%. I figured I would mention him for that. And then The last one I will mention is Jason Day at 7,400. I know that won't come as a shock to anyone listening, but there is GPP potential. He ranks 35th in my model when trying to find upside. And even if it's not, you know, value on the surface, placing him 34th in pricing in this field, there is an edge against purely ownership if he stays under 5%. He finished 7th here last year while struggling on Sunday and is ranked 6th in this field on long par 4s, 2nd at difficult par 4s, and is 30th in total driving. I wouldn't be using him if I'm making only a few builds, but this is the first event that he's been projected to make a cut in a while from my math. I think you could do a lot worse than cramming him into some lineups if you're making a plethora of rosters. But moving into $7,300 and below, I mentioned this earlier that Charlie Hoffman was one of my biggest advantages on the board. The recent form has been questionable, but we get all the narratives that typically spell out a Hoffman week, including Texas and wind. I like Ryan Palmer at 7,100. We saw some life from him at Mayakoba coming 27th. His preferred surface is Bermuda. His best play comes in windy conditions, and he ranks 7th at courses over 7,400 yards. And my model's all over Taylor Moore at 7,100. The one issue is that I don't have a ton of data to work with for him, but he's the second largest edge on the board right now in rank versus ownership if he stays under 1%. Lee Hodges is the first. Ryan Palmer is another notable at 5th. As always, you can get more of a breakdown from me if you check out the live show I do for Win Daily Sports with my guys, Sia Najat and Joel Schreck. That airs Tuesdays at 5 o'clock Pacific time. But round out the rest of this range for us, Tom, before we wrap this up in the 6,000s.
Yeah, I mean, just before we move on, just to go back again, sorry, is with Jason Day, is that again, for me, looking from a betting standpoint and from a narrative standpoint as opposed to a statistical one, is that when he came into this event last year, he was in absolutely woeful form. I mean, he finished fourth at the PGA back in August, but since then he was miscut 64th, 38th, miscut withdrawal 60th going into that week, and then managed to finish 7th. So for me, like, that's a sign that the course just suits, right? And you had it at Memorial, I think it was, and places like that, that you can just go back and play well. And then when you look at the last round that he played, he shot 65. So I think that there's chances that you can just flash here. Even if a couple of rounds, he could present value. But for me, there was two guys in the 7,000 range I really liked. And it was Martin Laird and Keith Mitchell. Martin Laird just plays really well. He's got top 10s in the Genesis, the Phoenix. He's won in Texas before. Keith Mitchell plays very, very well in Texas as well and has a recent top 5 finish. So again, both of those, and this is probably where I would struggle in terms of DFS over betting, because these guys would be like long shot chances in betting that are probably volatile and not to be trusted. But Martin Laird really just struck me as someone that looks pretty good value at $7,000.
Yeah, Laird and Mitchell are both positive values for me. And I guess just to backtrack with Jason Day again, I mean, I can never talk too much about Jason Day, so you're not like, you know, pulling my leg to try to talk about this one. But as you said, Day seems to always pop at the same venues when he likes a place. We've seen it in multiple occasions. Now, I guess the one outlier would be he always plays the Masters well. He didn't play the Masters particularly well this last go around with it. But I think Day's upside is just something that's worth looking at. If he's going to be sub 5%, like, you don't have to play very much of him to get overweight. But yeah, I mean, down in the $7,000 range, like, just to throw out a couple people that at least showed up as values for me that I did not mention. Emiliano Grillo was a slight value. Mitchell and Laird, as we said, Shanks showed as a very small value. But that's about it. I mean, most of the other names that I bypassed there are kind of a negative value on all things. I guess you could find some ownership differences. Harry Higgs is a very small value also, although Higgs seems to be a guy I can never get right. So, you know, take that.
I don't
for
even
what
try
it's
Harry.
Worth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I struggle with Harry Higgs.
There's a thing with Sia Najat. If I don't know how aware you are with Sia, but he does not like Harry Higgs in any capacity ever. And it's always like the ongoing joke that I bring Harry Higgs up. It never works out well. And Sia always is proven correct with that. But I guess let's wrap this up into the 6,000s. I noted last week that I thought the 6Ks provided robust routes to be taken. It was one of the reasons I was convinced stacking two of Hovland, Anser, Scheffler, and Thomas was the best strategy to go. But I don't have as much optimism this week, and it's kind of what you're saying. And I just think that this board in general doesn't lend itself to what I'm looking for. I guess if there are guys to throw out that I do like, Luke List should be viewed as a high ceiling, low floor pick at 6,900. he missed the cut in 2020. He missed the cut last week at Mayakoba. But it's these sort of big boy tracks that I always have envisioned List breaking through at for his first title. We see that statistically with him ranking sixth at venues over 7,400 yards. And he ranks 11th in weighted par five, as well as ninth in distance. Sahith Theegala feels like a nice fit at 6,900. It has been noted on this show before how he has overcome a wrist injury that derailed him in the past. His first place marks in bogey avoidance and scrambling give him real upside to compete on the first page if he puts it all together. I'm probably fine with Russell Knox and Tom Hoagie at the same price, although I do prefer Theegala and List. And then it kind of gets rough, in my opinion, from there. Francesco Molinari, which I know you've mentioned him earlier, I think he has a really good GPP trajectory and climbs to 17th when I include stats over my two-year model. That obviously is going to make sense when you consider what he was at his best, but he does slip to 73rd for safety. I mentioned Lee Hodges moments ago as my top leverage play. Three straight made cuts on tour, 24th when looking at just stats for the week. Despite the made cut streak, I do believe this is GPP only. Peter Uihlein, 6,400. He's being led by the putter, but it's hard to ignore how he scores on par fives. And then I guess Paul Bourgeon at 6,000. My model has him correctly priced at 7,000. So the fact that we get him at the stone minimum of 6K is at least a salary saver route if you want to look at it that way. But that will do it for me this week. What do you have down here?
So I have two guys that are at the top end of the 6K range that I really love, and it's James Harn at 6,800 and Adam Long at 6,800 as well. Adam Long is the type of guy that just plays the same course as well, right? And he played well here last year, generally plays okay in these sort of tests. And, you know, he finished tied 22nd, but he bogeyed the last two holes as a fall from tied 11th. So I think if he was 11th place, people would be a lot more on him this week, which is probably a good thing for ownership. James Harn is just, he just fits everything that I want him to do. Like he just plays well everywhere that I want him to play. The slightly worrying thing with James Harn, which is certainly a narrative as opposed to anything probably statistical, is that every time James Harn appears to fit, he struggles. So he won at Riviera and finished 13th there last year as well. He's got two top 11 finishes at the Phoenix Open. If you remember, Brooks won there this year, and James Harn actually had a three-stroke lead going into the back nine and threw that away. So he fits those two areas for me. He's got two top fives at Byron Nelson to suggest he likes Texas golf. And again, I think that Quail Hollow victory, like he did for Max Homa, represents some good signs. At the very bottom, I liked Wyndham Clark at 6,600. He's showing signs of coming back to form, plays these type of events well. He shot 61 in Phoenix to open a couple of years ago, which is a really nice thing to see. Matthew Neesmith potentially hitting the ball quite well, plays similar courses well. And then I keep falling for Jimmy Walker at the moment. I keep thinking that he's back. I keep thinking that he's put the kind of Lyme disease behind him slightly and hitting his ball well. And obviously, I don't need to say his Texas links, but 6,100 again. I think because you don't need to go down here, I probably wouldn't. But if you do really need to, then he could probably be a salary saver.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the way I view it, too. It's like I'm trying to avoid this section at all, not at all costs, but like I'm trying to avoid this section. If I get stuck in this range, Clark was a value for me. My model really liked James Harn, so it's in agreement with you there. My concern is exactly what you said with Harn. Any single time it looks like it's going to work, it never works for him. Adam Long, I've liked him the last couple weeks. I mean, the form looks like it's really turning around for him. My model's been up on him most of these weeks. The Jimmy Walker call is always interesting in Texas. And then I guess the one that I'm going to have you try to sell me on a little bit more, Matthew Neesmith, he screws me every single week. There is not a week that Neesmith does not, like, it's every single week. Statistically, he grades super well. And this isn't, I guess, from a model perspective, one of the best course fits for him. Like, I would prefer him at a course that was a little bit shorter. But with that being said, like, I have him as 28 spots of value from where he's at in price. So, I mean, that puts him more in like the low $7,000 range, which I don't know. I mean, thoughts on Neesmith though, of why you like
so
him?
Just in you know, the data that I use in the last kind of 8 weeks, he's had two performances where he's finished first and third in strokes gained approach, which is obviously massive for someone like Neesmith, and that is why he keeps burning people, because he keeps putting up those reasons. Seventh place finish at Phoenix Open was his second best performance according to OWGR. You know, another good finish for him was at the Genesis Invitational, where he was 20th. That was obviously at Riviera, which I do like. So he's just got two good performances at two courses that I do like, hitting the ball well. Again, like you, I can't get him right. So it does come with a bit of a warning to say, don't follow me in on Matthew Neesmith. But at 6,500, if you need to go down this far, then he's probably a decent option.
Maybe I'm miscorrectly playing Neesmith. I keep playing him at all these short venues and it doesn't work out. Maybe one of these longer venues is the way to go because he burns me every single time. Like if I play him at Harbortown, he burns me. If I play him at, you know, wherever, he ends up burning me. And from a 2-year perspective, he's 4th in approach. He's 9th over his last 24 rounds. Obviously, you have some issues with some other aspects of his game. And I think that iron play is what usually lends me to want to play him at these shorter tracks. But really, when you look at the proximity numbers, they seem to get better from 150 yards and over than they are from the shorter range. So there's a lot of long irons coming here. That's, you know, going to be something that's important. And as you said, like at least he has an elite skill set that he can look into. And that's what you're really looking for down in the $6,000 range when you're throwing darts. Like Wyndham Clark has that same elite skill set. If he hits the ball really long, and he can make putts. Like, just find me something that people are good at.
Yeah.
Neesmith can hit irons. Like, some of these guys that can do things that are a little bit better than everybody else, and maybe one of the other aspects of their game dwindle a little bit. That's what I'm looking for down here. But I think, you know, we went through this board pretty thoroughly from a DraftKings slate. But before I let you get out of here, I do want to get any bets you are thinking of placing or have placed up until this point. I know you've mentioned a couple, but give us the card so far.
Yeah, so for me, I loved Matthew Wolff. I think I'm just a guy, I'm a big fan of Matthew Wolff, and I think he's coming back to his best golf. And although he doesn't fit the kind of course fits that I like, I think when you look back in 10 years' time, he will do. I think they're just, you know, he hasn't been to them very often yet. Carlos Ortiz, I'm trusting just to go back and play very, very well. I know people don't like defending champions, but he's shown in the past that he can go back and do good things. Max Homer, as you mentioned earlier, is a good outright ticket, 50-1. And James Hahn for me was the other. I was pretty tempted by Adam Scott, I must admit. He was one that kind of jumped out to me as decent value at the top of the board. But Max Homer is probably my favorite bet of the week.
The thing with Wolff, I guess let's start with that with him. He's an interesting player because when he puts it together, he puts it together for long stretches of time. And we even saw that early in his career. He went like a year there or wherever it was without a top 10 finish. And then once he started producing more, like he gets wins, he gets top 10s and he puts it all together. So I think Wolff is intriguing for that reason. As far as the back-to-back narrative goes with Ortiz, like Hovland just proved that that can happen. Like I get the thought process that people don't think you can do that. But if a guy has shown that he likes a course, I'm not going to get off of the guy for that reason. And I think Ortiz grades very well for me. James Hahn's very interesting. I've considered him for a lot of aspects of how I'm going to do builds with it. And I mean, as far as my outright card goes right now, I will release the final wagers on my podcast, Better Golf. I actually have on an exciting guest this week, also an Andy Lack. I know you just did his show a few weeks ago also, Tom, but as of right now, I have Koepka and we'll get into the other ones tomorrow on that. But I wanted to thank you again for joining me on the show, man. It's a pleasure getting to talk to you. And please let everyone know one more time where they can find you and all your work.
Yeah, thank you, Spencer, for having me on. It's Tom Jacobs 93 on Twitter. I host the Lost for Words podcast, which you can find basically everywhere. The Mayo Media Network on YouTube, the European Tour Picks and Bets Show, and also on the Odds Checker US website, doing the early preview and the first round leader articles that come out on a Tuesday as well. So plenty of ways to find me. And thank you again, Spencer, for having me on.
Of course, you know, and one of the things is I stress to everybody, go follow Tom. Like I'm trying to have on guests that some of the people I respect the most in this industry and have conversations with them. I know that there's a lot of people that listen to the show. I want to provide an audience for other people out there. Tom does some of the best work out there. So please give him a follow. You can follow me on Twitter at Teeoff Sports. You can find this show at Be The Number Pod. And as Tom just said, you can find him at TomJacobs93. Good luck this week to everyone investing money into the Houston Open. And I hope we can do this again soon, man.
Yeah, thanks, Spencer.
All right, thanks, guys. Good luck.